Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
What the folk is up? It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Andy and Don with me. Andy, I know you really love misuse of the word folk. How are you doing today?
Big apology to everyone out there for all the ensuing puns. Sorry.
Get the folk out of here. Don?
Oh, just excited to go on a trip upon your magic swirling ship.
Oh, wow. No one's ever said that to me before.
You guys need a minute over there?
That was really moving. My bowels. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and just spending time together, quality time. We have a great show for you today. We are each going to present a folk album of some repute. Don's going to ask us a deep question. And then we're going to have some shout-outs to some albums and album-related items we're digging. And then we'll be reaching into Santa's sack to announce what we'll be talking about on the next episode. Ho, ho, ho. But this week, it's all about that folk. It's all about the folk. The folk. The folk. No treble.
That's what I'm talking about!
The mid-century folk revival, spanning from the 1940s to the 1960s, brought traditional American music back into the spotlight and introduced a new generation of singer-songwriters. This movement, fueled by social and political unrest, saw artists like Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, Joan Baez, and Bob Dylan using acoustic instruments and simple melodies to address issues such as civil rights and war. The folk revival not only had a lasting impact on popular music and culture, but also established music as a powerful tool for social change, inspiring artists and audiences alike with its rich repository of hidden and unsettling stories about America.
Wow.
Wow. Today, each of us will present an album from the mid-century folk revival.
Did you get that from the History Channel? Dang. So yeah, folk music of that era is fascinating because of what it became. And there was a lot to choose from here. Some of it new to me, some of it very familiar. What other albums did you guys consider before making your final choice? So what else did you think about?
Well, a lot of this stuff is new to me. One such group that stuck out was The Brothers Four and their 1960 album BMOC. Do you guys know what that stands for?
BMOC.
BMOC, that's right. Big Man on Campus. The Brothers Four were in a fraternity in Seattle, Washington, and got together. This is their fifth studio album. Lots of four-part harmonies.
Were they like Constance Fry? Yeah. Constance Fry.
Constance Fry.
Trading Places.
Constance Fry. All right. Yeah, it's the elements of blues and country mixed in there with the folk sound. What did you find in your listenings, Don?
Well, one of the big names in folk music at the time was Peter, Paul, and Mary. I checked out their self-titled debut from 1962. Peter, Paul, and Mary is Peter Yarrow, Paul Stuckey, and Mary Travers. They were just all over the charts at that time, but mainly covers. There's Pete Seeger's If I Had a Hammer and the song Lemon Tree, which is by somebody called Will Holt. But, you know, it's a palatable folk record, I'd say.
As a little kid, I saw them a lot. Like, their concerts would be on PBS, mm-hmm. you know. And I liked them because they had that Puff the Magic Dragon song. Mm-hmm. So one of the albums I considered was Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl Ballads. Woody Guthrie kind of being the godfather of this era of folk, I would say, influenced artists like Bob Dylan. He gave voice to the struggles of working class Americans during the 20th century, during the Dust Bowl period. And this album gets into the Great Depression and with poignant storytelling, and songs like Tom Joad and Dust Bowl Blues are featured on this one, but wasn't quite what I was looking for. So why don't we get into our cha-cha choices?
You choo-choo choose me?
All right, for my mid-century folk revival selection, we're talking about Joan Baez and her 1960 debut, Joan Baez.
I mean, if I want to lick a hippie, I'll just return Joan Baez's phone calls.
That's a good one.
All right. Joan hails from the New York City area of New York State. She rose to prominence after her performance at the Newport Folk Festival, the first one, which was in 1959. Let's play a little bit of the opening cut. This is Silver Dagger.
Says my mother, they'll tell you wicked, loving life.
Coors should have made like a really hard malt liquor that was called Silver Dagger instead of the Silver Bullet.
Taste the Silver Dagger.
Yeah. That would have been a perfect jingle for it as well. Just the kind of energy that Coors is trying to sell.
Yeah, sure. Joan would have been all over that commercial. That's a really dark song. Kind of about giving up on men, probably drinking too much. I mean, it might be a tie in there somewhere, Don. The singer's mother has been wronged and kind of forbids her daughter to make the same mistake of trusting men with their love. So she carries this silver dagger, which I assume is used to kind of like threaten her daughter or keep away the men from her daughter. Pretty dark stuff, and I kind of love it. My clickbait headline for Joan Baez's self-titled debut is, "If Joan was a door-to-door folk saleswoman, I'd Baez."
Oh, God.
Worried about the puns.
I do miss those door-to-door folk salesmen.
Yeah, I don't see them around much anymore. This record is very simple sonically. It's a collection of folk standards. I know these are originals, but Baez kind of gives them her own little spin in terms of the arrangements. I would say her vocal is very ethereal, very much on the high end of the register. Mm-hmm. And her guitar, which is primarily, it's just her and the guitar, acoustic guitar, of course, as you'd expect in a folk record. And it works really well together. It's fairly poignant. She gives great deliveries on these tracks. Her tone, I would say, shifts a fair amount throughout some of these songs, sometimes very quickly. She can go from being very soft to very loud, kind of like the Pixies a little bit. In some way.
She was a folk singer.
Folk singer.
Yeah, I mean, even though vocally it isn't, like, we're not talking the difference of a scream and angelic. It's more about, like, the choir of angels fills in more at times, and then, you know, in terms of the tone. But I know what you're talking about with the loud, soft.
Yeah, she really has a powerful voice, but you oftentimes don't hear it, or she'll kind of keep it very restrained.
Because she chooses her moments.
Yes, she punctuates them nicely. Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear another cut from the record. This is All My Trials.
Baby, don't you cry. You know your mama was born to die.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah, folk music is a downer, bro.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the traditional stuff.
Yeah. I actually knew that song. You ever hear Elvis Presley's American Trilogy? Where it has like Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. It's like a medley of this song and Dixie and Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. Anyways, so Baez popularized this song. It actually had been introduced to the folk scene by Bob Gibson's 1956 album Offbeat Folk Songs, where it was titled Bahamian Lullaby or Bahamian Lullaby. But that's another one of those where they don't really know where it came from.
Yeah. Mm. So many of these have like mysterious origins or they just kind of appeared and somebody heard it.
Yeah, that's kind of the cool thing about folk music. You know, if you're really into it, I mean, you could really go on a quest to find the origins of the song.
Yeah.
And that quest, of course, could inspire some great folk songs that you would write along the way.
True. So the song tells the story of a mother on her deathbed comforting her children with the assurance that her trials will soon be over.
Because she'll be dead.
Yes. Yep.
Wow. So dark.
Well, the part where there's like, don't you cry, your mother's gonna die. Like,
sounds like a Metallica lyric. All right, well, my clickbait headline for Joan Baez Volume 1, which I think some people refer to it as, is Meet Donna Donna, John Riley, Mary Hamilton, Henry Martin, Little Moses, and most importantly, Joan Baez's voice and guitar.
So cast of characters on this one.
Yeah. I guess what I was most impressed with on this album is the guitar work. I think it's just a cool thing about folk music in general, you know, that finger-picking style.
It's finger-picking good.
Very good. It's almost like it's several instruments. You know, they make good use of the, you know, the bass strings, you know, to provide that low end, and then you've got, you know, the higher strings, you know, playing a melody or arpeggios or whatever. Yeah, it's just really impressive that you don't need another instrument. You know, I mean, she's obviously just a talented guitarist. It's busy at times, but it doesn't distract from her voice. So like, I think the whole presentation is, you know, listen to these lyrics, even her voice, you know, I mean, she just speaks very clearly or sings very clearly, good diction or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you just catch every word, you know, unlike Eddie Vedder or somebody, you know, where sometimes you're like, what, what was that?
Yeah. It sounds like she's like right in your ear, the way it's recorded, really just her and the guitar. There's a couple tracks that do have some accompaniments that sound a little bit larger, but yeah, for the most part, it's really a focused record, I would say.
Focused.
All right. Why don't we hear another cut from the record? This is track 4, House of the Rising Sun.
One of those moments where the voice gets louder, if you want to call it that. Yeah, so this song has been around quite a while, dating back to the 18th century in England. Its exact authorship is unknown, but it was brought to the United States via Appalachian ballad traditions. You know, and I think I of course think about Eric Burdon's version, New Orleans, and all that. But this is a probably a more traditional presentation. It tells a story of a person's downfall, attributed to things like, you know, vices like gambling, alcoholism, poor life choices. The House of the Rising Sun is commonly interpreted as a metaphor for a brothel or a gambling den. Basically, a place of moral corruption. It ain't church.
House of ill repute.
Yes. But then there's the theme of, as in a lot of traditional folk music, the narrator is seeking to atone for their mistakes. So there's a moral lesson to be learned. My clickbait headline to describe Joan Baez's Joan Baez: the album that took old-time folk songs and made them sound fresh, timeless, and totally heavenly.
Totally.
These are sad songs, but the lilting vocal range and that deep connection to the tradition of folk music, even in a modern era of the early 60s, is just a really nice way to present it in its purest form and make people truly listen. It's haunting and emotionally rich. Yeah, if Aretha is the queen of soul, I would say she's the queen of folk.
The queen of folk.
I think a lot of the folk singers, your Joni Mitchells, etc., inspired by this style.
Yeah, it seemed like she was kind of right at the forefront of it as it was kind of coming into its own here in the early 60s. Yeah, this album has been added to the National Recording Registry back in 2015. It's part of 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die, etc., etc. All those indicators are here that this is one of those important records that I think deserves to be heard if you're not familiar with it. I think it's a good representation of that that mid-century folk revival. So Joan Baez, Joan Baez.
Before we continue on our journey of mid-century folk, let's hear a word from the Abandoned Albums podcast.
Our mission at Abandoned Albums is simple. As simple as this ad. Our only goal is to keep the recorded work of artists on the cultural radar and showcase new artists who should be on the cultural radar. Some things in life are truly that simple. With our tongue firmly in cheek, it's why we say Abandoned Albums is the only music podcast that matters, and it's available wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Thanks, Abandoned Albums. Go check them out.
Right. Well, my journey to mid-century folk went back to June 1958 to the debut album from the Kingston Trio. They're a group formed in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1957. The original trio is Dave Gard, Bob Shane, and Nick Reynolds. By the way, they actually tour now, but it's none of these guys. There's been 50 different incarnations of the Kingston Trio.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's kind of like Menudo, where they just replace members constantly as they age out.
So this record was recorded in 3 days with producer Voyle Gilmore, known for producing people like Frank Sinatra.
A Voyle rules.
Oh, sorry. Features a mix of traditional songs, calypso-flavored tunes, and some contemporary numbers. Well, here's sort of the big hit from this album, Tom Dooley.
Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to
die. Now the feel-good side of folk music, the Kingston Trio. Totally different vibe than Joan Baez.
Yep. But funny, you know, dark subject matter, but just kind of like a presented.
Rosy presentation.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're like doing cartoony voices through it and stuff. Yeah, it's definitely.
It's wild.
It feels more like, you know, when you're in elementary school and there's an afternoon concert and some musicians show up to teach you lessons about life. It'd be these dudes.
So Tom Dooley is a traditional folk song based on the 1866 murder of a woman named Laura Foster in Wilkes County, North Carolina, by somebody named Tom Doola, who I guess in the local dialect was pronounced Dooley. A local poet named Thomas Land wrote a song about the tragedy titled Tom Dooley shortly after Doola was hanged. And the Kingston Trio learned the song from Frank Warner, who had learned it from Frank Prophet. And, you know, Prophet's version had been passed down through his family, apparently an aunt, Nancy Prather, actually knew Laura Foster and Tom Doola. So, yeah, almost like a direct lineage.
Wow.
But the Kingston Trio were later forced to pay royalties because they hadn't given Prophet credit for the use of the version. But it was a huge hit, very big hit.
Yeah. And then the family profited from murder.
It's true, right? I mean.
Murder most foul.
Well, my clickbait headline for the Kingston Trio's debut album is Tom Dooley hung down his head and launched a folk revolution. So these guys were huge commercially. In fact, this album was actually on the charts for almost 4 years.
Wow, 4 years.
And some people actually credit this album with helping kind of elevate the LP or establishing the LP as a format. It does seem like in the world of folk, the albums kind of matter more so than even rock and roll at the time. So the producer Gilmore actually had, you know, some significant input on this album. He did add a session player, Elmer Buzz Wheeler, to play some bass to fill out the low end. But other than that, it's just you know, a couple of guitars and a bass,
banjo,
and a banjo, yes. Yeah. And they didn't add any orchestral accompaniment, which was typical of folk records at the time. It sounds really good.
Yeah, it's nice. All
right, well, let's hear another cut. Here's the wreck of John B.
I wanna go home.
I want to go home. So
I stop the John B. sails. See how the main sails.
See how the main. Yeah, maybe we should do that for the rest of the show, and just one guy repeats the last guy, whatever they say last. Darn, that's your cue to be like, whatever they say last. Come on, jeez.
You blew it. I missed it.
So it's a traditional Bohemian folk song, first transcribed by Richard LaGaglia. Maybe it's more like Galleon, I'm not sure.
Galleon.
In 1916, originally titled The John B. Sails or Wreck of the John B. I love how it's like there's a million different potential titles for this thing. It's the story of a chaotic voyage aboard a sloop plagued by drunkenness and disorder. The Kingston Trio popularized their version, which introduced a more polished folk style, but those clear harmonies and rhythmic strumming, but that whole call and response thing they're doing. I believe that's why this version directly influenced the Beach Boys' famous rendition, Sloop John B. Al Jardine. We talked about this on the Pet Sounds episode, but a member of the Beach Boys, a big folk music enthusiast, and convinced Brian Wilson to adapt the song for Pet Sounds. And that's kind of, in my mind, the definitive version. But this is it's cool to hear the one that inspired it. My clickbait headline to describe this album: murder ballads, banjo solos, humor, and chart success. Folk revival starts here. I feel like bringing folk to this poppy side of things, this friendlier version of it, even though it's dark stuff, where they do very interesting cartoonish voices in some of the songs and accents. It strikes a balance between lighthearted tunes and darker ballads. And it's breezy, but it helped redefine the genre, appealing to folk purists and casual listeners. And I think the casual listeners were the key to the success here.
Yeah, definitely in terms of spreading the popularity of the genre. Feels like these guys appealed to a pretty broad audience.
Well, let's hear some more. Let's take a trip to Bay of Mexico.
Great transition.
Around the Bay of Mexico.
What is happening here? I'm confused by the subject of the lyrics and then the sound of the music.
Yeah, I had to get out of Globe and just verify that there was not a Bay of Mexico. Anyway, we got a nice kind of song with like an island vibe there.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Yeah, there's a handful of tracks on the album that do have kind of this Latin Caribbean vibe going on, which I think is kind of interesting. My clickbait headline for the Kingston Trio is, they're not quite from Jamaica.
Not quite.
But the trio bring plenty of sunshine to the folk sound.
They did live in Hawaii for a while.
What's that got to do with Jamaica, dude?
It's an island.
it is near the water. No, these are three of the whitest guys you'll ever see from the Bay Area. Yeah. But some of the music really does have a great island sound to it, which I appreciated. I didn't expect that in folk music.
Kind of similar to what Harry Belafonte was doing at that time.
Yeah, that's where I feel like the Kingston Trio, I mean, I would definitely say that they take folk and they mix it with other types of worldly sounds, but they completely whitewash it and make it all sanitary for the 1958 listening audience.
The Pat Boones of folk music.
Yeah. I think that's fair. It's not to say that these aren't fun, engaging songs, though. And if I was a, you know, a school-aged person at this time, I think I would really gravitate towards this music. And I could see why it became popular over the next decade or so, because it's just kind of fun, engaging stuff. Yeah, there's the guitar accompaniments Don mentioned there, that they play as a group, largely rhythm focused, I would say, just kind of moving the songs forward. But there are a couple of tracks that do diverge into some bluegrass territory, especially with the banjo sound there. The one I liked the most was called Cerro Jane, which is kind of in the middle of the record. So yeah, when they do stretch their legs a little bit, I think it's a little more interesting. But still really an engaging, just kind of light, fun listen about some really dark, twisted stuff.
Yeah. And these are guys that definitely said gee whiz quite a bit, I would say. Gee whiz, Don. That was quite a folk experience.
But yeah, it is kind of cool. It is sort of like a trip around the globe, you know, to the folk music of different areas, you know, which is very much the spirit of folk music.
It's true.
All right. Well, the Kingston Trio's self-titled debut album from 1958 is a landmark recording that helped revitalize folk music. Check it out.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. Listening to a lot of these songs, like, you know, Tom Dooley, it reminded me of, like, music class in elementary school. You know, we used to do a lot of, you know, songs like this and playing, you know, sort of those earthy instruments. What do you guys remember about music class or, you know, music education in your younger days?
Yeah, I spent a good amount of time in the music room in my school because I was in the band.
Ooh, what'd you play?
Alto sax.
I did that for a year.
Yeah. I made it a couple, but not much more. My strongest memory was just feeling really bad for our teacher, man. Because I felt it was like 40 kids. None of us could really play these instruments in this huge room. Just chaos and noise. And one adult trying to contain all this and make it sound like something. Well, thankless job. I mean, all respect out to other music teachers around the world. God bless you. I don't know how you do that job and still appreciate music at the end of the day. I knew it was bad at the time and I was a young kid.
Hey, if they can just touch one life like yours, Andy. I mean, look what you've become.
Well, look at me
now. A music
now,
podcaster.
Right?
I know, you're a superstar.
How about you, dude?
Oh, so I was thinking back a little further than that to kindergarten music teacher, Mrs. Hines. She'd come in like once a week with a cart, come into our classroom with a cart full of different instruments and stuff. And we would have jam sessions. So we'd all get to pick like a triangle or the sticks to either hit together or the ribbed ones to rub together for different types of music or cowbells and all that kind of stuff. And I really enjoyed it when she'd bring, you know, the art teacher did the same thing, bring a cart of stuff in. But
was there a Les Paul on the cart?
No, this is all tambourines and stuff, but we'd all be skipping around in circles, playing our instruments.
Yeah, that sounds really fun.
Yeah, just, you know, musical abandon. And I'm sure it was much more adorable than what your teacher was looking at. You know, you got a bunch of 5-year-olds skipping around, hitting triangles and stuff. It's cute. When it's a bunch of middle schoolers, it's probably frustrating. What about you, Don?
Well, actually, I remember joining chorus, I think like in third or fourth grade.
You? Shocking.
You like to sing? Really?
But I just remember this one weird rehearsal like before our holiday concert, and like four people just like passed out. Like it just kept happening. What?
Is there like a gas leak or something?
I don't think so. I don't know. But our teacher told us to like wiggle our toes, you know, to keep the blood circulating. So I don't remember if it was like particularly hot, or maybe we just weren't used to standing still for that long. But yeah, like three or four kids like just went down.
I'm sorry to laugh, but that's... Yeah.
I mean, everybody was okay, but yeah.
I guess the music was just so overpowering. Yeah. You guys must have been a really talented bunch of singers.
We were singing Reindeer Rock, I think it was.
Ooh, yeah.
Very moving.
Yeah. I get woozy when I sing Reindeer Rock.
Yeah, well, what do you remember from your music education? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
Well, we can't talk folk revival without Bob Dylan, can we? And we certainly can't do it without doing that terrible Bob Dylan voice. I'm so sorry. So I went with the 1965 album Bringing It All Back Home. Is Bob Dylan's fifth studio album and kind of a turning point for folk music by introducing electric instruments on half of the tracks. The first half and the second half are more traditional acoustic folk songs. It bridged the gap between folk and rock, laying the groundwork for the folk rock genre, which became insanely popular throughout the 60s and into the 70s, and it reflected the changing cultural landscape of the 60s, aligning with the rise of counterculture and all the political unrest and whatnot. So Dylan's ability to write intensely personal yet politically charged songs made him a voice for his generation. Why don't we check out a little bit of the opening track, Subterranean Homesick Blues. That was a groundbreaking Dylan track that sort of blended Chuck Berry rock beats with poetry's stream of consciousness style. And those rapid-fire lyrics that are about social discontent, drug paranoia, civil rights, rebellion, all of it kind of encapsulates that mid-60s period. And then that iconic cue card music video, or film probably at the time, shot where he's got the cue cards with the lyrics and he's throwing the cards.
Often imitated many times.
Yes, very perfectly by NXS.
Gotta mediate, gotta love your mate.
And it's a great opening track for the album to sort of set this stage for a change is a gonna come. My clickbait headline to describe the album: Dylan's got a tambourine and a plug, and he's gonna use them. Bringing It All Back Home shocks the folk world. Don't follow leaders. Watch the parking meters. Do your own thing, you know? So, yeah, there's not much more to say. It is a turning point in his career and in the trajectory of popular music. Why don't we jump in with the first song of side two, and the first of the more traditional acoustic, Mr. Tambourine Man.
It was you in kindergarten.
Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to.
You well-known Dylan track there. Seems to be about seeking guidance, whether that's from a person or music or spiritual or drugs, some kind of guidance.
Yeah, I looked into that, and I always believed it was about like a musician, a folk singer, and apparently it was inspired by an actual guy that played this large drum that had bells on it, kind of like a giant tambourine. And I always thought it was just about sharing music and sharing stories. And then in college, everyone convinced me it was about a drug dealer, but I reject that as I've done some research. I don't think it had anything to do with that, but
hard to say. A lot of these Dylan songs are pretty dense lyrically to unpack. My clickbait headline for Bringing It All Back Home is Dylan plugs in, but the real power is in his expansive lyrics.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, this record, you could kind of just feel like Dylan, like, sort of single-handedly pushing the genre forward here. I mean, obviously, the electric component is controversial and kind of a big deal. But I think even outside of just the electric component and sort of the larger rock sound, I think Dylan is really tapping into some creativity. Maybe some of that is the freedom that comes from having that electric sound here, but his lyrics are just top notch on this album. Might be some of the best songwriting I think I've heard from him. Just so creative and expansive. His work I've going back to so many bold ideas and so many tracks that just really get out there. I had never heard Bob Dylan's 115th Dream before. That's a pretty wild psychedelic cut there. It's rambling lyrics and goes all those different places in terms of the story. And I mean, even the tracks later, It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding, just some really beautiful lyrics in that track. And I don't know. I appreciate the electric rock sound, but I really think he's still at his best when he's just him on the acoustic guitar, and you can really appreciate what he's saying and how he's delivering it.
Yeah, even the folkier tracks have, I think, more of a blues feel than, you know, some of his earlier stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I think that also gave him some freedom. I mean, blues music is pain. Folk music traditionally is pain. So he was tapping into the same pain vein, just using some new sounds to express it all.
Fair enough.
All right, so why don't we jump into another track? This one is called Gates of Eden.
Of war and peace, the truth just twists its curfew gull, it glides.
Yeah, so this is, you know, sort of that traditional folk sound, but the lyrics are, you know, this is not blowing in the wind. It's not Goodnight Irene, you know, I mean, this is kind of real, like, surreal, you know, again, surreal, yeah. Dreamlike imagery. There's a cowboy angel searching for sun with a black wax candle, you know, it's...
Yeah.
It's a lot of metaphor going on.
Yeah.
The beat poet in him really was allowed to come out here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that song consists of 8 verses, each presenting a separate description of a decaying society. Somebody said he was critiquing the notion of a forgiving afterlife, suggesting that blind belief in that concept creates complacency in the present world.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So my clickbait headline for bringing it all back home is Dylan introduces surrealism to rock and roll. I'm not sure we had a lot of that before 1965. You know, I mean, even the Beatles were still, you know, holding your hand and,
you
know. I mean, he's influencing two genres at the same time. And I mean, basically just blurring the lines of it, you know, because is it blues? Is it folk? Is it rock and roll? You know, it's, I don't know. It's just, it's Dylan.
Whoa.
What I was impressed with on this album is, even though the lyrics are goofy, and I mean, they don't seem to make any sense, somehow there's still like a universal quality or something. Like, I still feel connected to him. I'm like, yeah, Bob, you're right. But I, you know, I don't really know what the hell he's talking about, but I get it, you know?
Well, even if it's a line at a time, you know, a line at a time where the feeling of the delivery can kind of set you on the right course. Like, you know, it's all over now, Baby Blue, the closing track, where he's saying goodbye to his former way of life, maybe a lover, maybe the music he was doing, you know, but even though all the lyrics don't connect directly, it's the feeling that he's able to convey without a lot of instrumentation. The emotion behind the words is sometimes more important than the words themselves.
Yeah, I was reading a quote from Joan Baez, who was, you know, staying with him in Woodstock when he was working on this. And she said he just was in the corner on the typewriter, you know, constantly. So, I mean, he was like writing his lyrics on a typewriter, you know, not with an acoustic guitar or something. You know, it's interesting.
Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds like a news reporter more than a beat poet.
Yeah, so, I mean, this album changed the direction of music, so I'm going to nominate this for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. I mean, we've already all said some pretty glowing stuff about this record. Obviously, it's a yes for me. I'm going to leave the vote up to you guys.
Yeah, you know, I was not that familiar with this record. I maybe listened to it a handful of times. For some reason, it doesn't really come up or in my Dylan catalog in my head. It's not like among the high, like his classics, but man, it is. It should be.
Yeah.
It is really good. Yes for me.
Yeah, I wanted to do Highway 61 Revisited, also from 1965, which is all, you know, rock, but it didn't quite fit the full theme of this show. And being forced to spend more time with this than I ever have before, I'm convinced it's one of his best. So I'm glad we did this. How do you feel about it, Don?
I love it too. And I mean, I have to just give it credit for basically creating folk rock. You know, I mean, there's no Simon and Garfunkel without this. So thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. All right, so Album Nerds Hall of Famer, Bringing It All Back Home by Bob Dylan. Go check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Well, we've been on a journey, you know, touring these United States and the world at large, listening to folk music. What else have you been digging this week?
Well, I got a couple things here stashed inside my acoustic guitar.
It's where you keep the drugs.
Yeah, tambourine man.
You found me out. All right, well, the first one I mentioned here is from a country rock five piece from Mobile, Alabama, called The Red Clay Strays. They have an album out called Made by These Moments. Now let's play track six, Drowning.
Yeah, I now remember them. Yeah, the sort of, what's that guy's name, like Chris Staplehammer or something? Like, it was a little
on the nose. Stapleton there, perhaps. But it's still really good. I've been enjoying it quite a bit. It's made it up all the way to number 8 on my year-end list at the moment.
Whoa. And that's a list of like 1,000 albums, usually.
That's a good ranking by them. Another one to mention, too, is from the Catskill Mountain area of New York. Talk about the Felice Brothers. They have an album out called The Valley of Abandoned Songs. They're a four-piece, I would say kind of like Americana indie rock space. Let's play the opening cut, Crime Scene Queen. She sang like a dream.
She's a crime scene.
Queen with a laser beam.
Yeah, it works. Could have been the old there. There's a handful of really catchy songs on that record. Overall, it's pretty good. I had it come in at number 94 on my list, so not quite as good as the Red Clay Strays, but still a solid record there from the Felice Brothers. What you been digging on, Don?
Well, just the other day, I watched a documentary film called Yacht Rock. A documentary, but clever spelling. It's doc.
D-O-C-K. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a film by Garrett Price. It's part of that Music Box series of films that HBO and Max has. So this one was about yacht rock, and it has appearances from like Kenny Loggins and Michael McDonald and Toto. And
who now probably all own yachts because of their vast riches.
Yeah, I wish I had seen this documentary before we did that episode. I think episode 199, we did Yacht Rock.
Did you learn anything new about the genre, though?
Oh, yeah, tons. And they do a really good job of just showing how well done it was and just how good some of it was.
The music?
The music, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's see. We got one more for your Christmas stocking. A group called the Milk Carton Kids. Their Christmas album is called Christmas in a Minor Key, released just this year. The Milk Carton Kids are an indie folk duo from Eagle Rock, California, featuring Kenneth Pattingale and Joey Ryan. Kind of Simon and Garfunkel-ish. Sort of fits our theme this week.
Has anyone found them yet, since they're on the milk cartons? That's like missing children, right?
The search continues.
Yeah. Too many people buy the full gallon. You don't get the picture if you buy a plastic jug. Here's God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen.
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay.
Cool.
Remember Christ.
Finally, something that sounds kind of interesting instead of the usual canned garbage.
Remember that John Fahey record? Yeah. That with harmonies, kind of. What are you digging, dude?
So I'm kind of in a different headspace, I guess, from you guys. Maybe I needed to shake loose some of that heady folk. Got a band called Uniform. The name of the album is American Standard, released in August of this year. They're an industrial metal band known for their abrasive sound and dark themes. They were formed in 2013 in New York City. Let's listen to a little bit of This Is Not a Prayer. So they continue their aggressive experimental approach here, noise rock, heavy industrial. And according to the Needle Drop, I quote, the Feel Bad album of 2024. it's definitely not uplifting. Let's put it that way. On the flip side, recently added to my vinyl collection, we're going to go with something that is uplifting. Living Colors 1988 Vivid. It's not a fancy colored vinyl, just the standard black. It's not like a rare version or anything. It's just nice to have it in the collection. Living Color, groundbreaking American rock band formed in 1984, known for their fusion of hard rock, funk, and metal. Why don't we listen to a little bit of the big one, Cult of Personality. Yeah, so it's an upbeat mix of politically charged lyrics, kind of a, at the time, genre-defying mix of sounds, kind of solidified their place in rock history. I think they get a lot more respect now than they even did in 1988 for their contribution. So go check out Living Color Vivid if you haven't heard it before.
All right. Well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great American singer-songwriter Woody Guthrie, who said, it's a folk singer's job to comfort disturbed people and to disturb comfortable people.
Isn't that what we do?
Love it.
Pretty much our goal in the Albumnerds podcast as well. I thought that was a pretty succinct way to do it. Yeah. Well, as we approach the end of the year here, we're taking a little bit of a detour from our normally scheduled programming, and we'll be reaching into Santa's sack here for next week. Let's see what we got in store for you guys.
I'm gonna scrape bottom, brother.
I'd rather get in Mrs. Claus's stockings.
Hey.
Oh, jeez.
Hey. So,
wow. Okay, then. All right, so we'll be looking for some classic Christmas albums to discuss. Stay tuned. Check it out.
Well, what's your favorite holiday album? What else are you listening to? Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. Also, please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time where we get holly jolly with some Christmas albums.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you then.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Gonna get a lot of that next week.
Yeah, hopefully Andy shares some of his beautiful vocal pipes with us.
Bah humbug. Out of here.